I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. In today's partisan environment, liberals and conservatives rarely interact, rarely agree on the facts, and live in a very different media and cultural world. Not so long ago, the conventional wisdom said that liberals failed at talk radio, witnessed the demise of Air America, while conservatives couldn't find an audience hosting a late-night political comedy show, witnessed the half-hour news hour. Our guest, Danigal Goldthwait-Young, explores this phenomenon in her new book, Irony and Outrage, The Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter in the United States. She says that while liberals and conservatives have different mindsets, even different psychologies, the audience for Sean Hannity and John Oliver have more in common than you might think. She tweeted recently that they are both high in political interest, knowledge, and engagement, and both lack faith in many of our core democratic institutions. Danigal Young is an associate professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware and at the University Center for Political Communication. She's also an improvisational comedian, has performed with Comedy Sports Philadelphia for 20 years. This is her sixth time on Radio Times. And Danigal, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Well, let's begin in the summer of 2002. You were a production assistant for The Daily Show.
Oh, yeah, summer of 2000.
Excuse me. 2000, yeah. Of course. And the DNC was having, actually the RNC was having their convention in Philadelphia. We were there. You were there as a production assistant for The Daily Show. Stephen Colbert gave you some advice. What did he tell you?
Yeah, so this was a really wonderful experience. It was 10 days, and the cast of The Daily Show was actually housed in the University of Pennsylvania's graduate towers, those big concrete towers. And they have very fun memories of this time. And you know, some of the correspondents were intrigued that I was in graduate school studying media and communication. They said, "What do you do with that?" And I said, "Well, I might get my master's and then move to New York and continue doing improv, or I might continue for my doctorate." And Stephen Colbert said, basically, "How much will it cost you to get a doctorate?" And I said, "Well, if I get into the program, it's free." And he said, "Do you know how hard the world of improv comedy is?" And at the time, he was in his mid-30s, and he said, "Do you know how many times I've been rejected? Do you know how awful it is?" He's like, "I'm just barely arriving maybe now." And he said that if he had the choice that I had, which was to go and get a PhD in something that I loved and was good at, he would do that. So either I could look at it as he helped shape my future in a positive way, or perhaps he prevented me from being a comic success.
Well,
I don't know.
I think you've ended up doing both, because here you do teach, but you also do improv, which is a kind of a stand-up, and it certainly involves comedy, surprise.
Right. I feel so lucky because I research, I teach. Right now I have 150 undergraduates and 9 doctoral students that I teach. And I perform fairly regularly with a wonderful improvisational comedy troupe. And we do 2 shows every Saturday night for audiences that are extremely diverse, ranging from children to grandparents to bachelorette parties. And we make things up on the spot. It is not satire. It's not political. We try to just concentrate on the construction of humor and making things up in the moment.
It's funny. I had to, I Googled several words for today's interview. Satire, irony, humor,
You're
even
a good
comedy.
Student, Margie.
I mean, these are such basic things, but at the same time,
This
is what we're talking about. And there are differences between all those genres.
Correct. So the way that I present it to my students is that humor is the giant construct. That's the big umbrella under which all these things fall. Underneath humor, you have satire. And satire, the definition that I use is always by George Test, who wrote that satire is playful, designed to elicit laughter. It's not like it gets laughter by accident. It's designed to do that. It aims at a target and it makes a specific judgment. And it makes a judgment in a way that invites us all to consider our own complicity in whatever that is being targeted. So that's satire.
Right.
Within that, you also have an overlapping concept, which is irony. And that's, I mean, Alanis Morissette did not understand the concept, Marty. I'm just going to tell you that. A fly in your Chardonnay, not ironic.
Not ironic.
A real pain in the bottom, but not ironic. Maybe gross. So irony as a concept, the way that linguists define it and the definition I use, is when the literal when the literal words and the intended meaning of that statement are at odds with one another. And we talk about valence, which is positive or negative. So the valence, in an ironic statement, the valence of the literal words are opposite of the intended meaning. So it's describing something as wonderful when it's terrible, or describing something as terrible when it's wonderful. This is a wonderful vehicle for all kinds of humor. And the reason it works so well for satire and political satire is because the valence can be a contrast between the ideal, or what ought to be, the way the world should be, and what actually is. And you can describe the way the world is as though it's great, knowing that it's not.
Right.
Or you can describe the way that the world should be as though it is what is, and it's not.
Well, let me play Conan O'Brien, and you actually quote him in this monologue in your book, and this is from his TBS show, Conan, and this is 2016, right before the election of 2016.
Bad news for Donald Trump. I don't know if you heard, but Donald Trump has dropped to second place in a national poll. He's at second place now. Yeah. Yeah. On the bright side, he's still polling number one among Germans of the 1930s.
Irony.
Right. And what makes it irony is that he says on the bright side. Okay. So his literal words state that this is a good thing. We know that what he means is this is devastating, and it means awful things about Trump and about the people who support him. What's interesting is that this example I love because it really exemplifies how humor and satire are incomplete without the contribution of the audience, right? This has been at the heart of my work for 20 years, the notion that because humor requires the audience to contribute something in order to understand it, when humor is used to make a political point, there's magic in that because you're not actually saying the judgment. Conan's not saying Trump's supporters are Nazis. He's not saying Trump's supporters are white nationalists. Like, imagine the blowback if he said that.
Right.
Instead.
And it would not be funny.
Exactly. So what he's doing is he's creating a comic juxtaposition that is a textbook late night joke construction. And it invites us, the audience, to come in and make that judgment. And there's power in that rhetorically. It's also cognitively complex.
And I do want to get to the role of the audience. All right, we took care of the first word in your book, irony. Mm. Let's deal with outrage. And on the one hand, I do think, sort of broadly speaking, that most people in this country, maybe even the world, are outraged. They're
right.
Outraged about something. But you're
right.
Using that word in a very different way.
Right. The term outrage can be used to describe an emotion. The way that the title of the book and the concept in the book are designed to capture a genre of political information. And this is something that I borrow from a book called The Outrage Industry by Jeff Berry and Sarah Soberai. They define the outrage industry as a particular kind of political content that's exemplified by Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, maybe Bill O'Reilly, where you have a solo host who is very serious, very didactic in their presentation of information. I wouldn't say in their presentation of facts because they're not always factual. They are threat-oriented. They're trying to signify signal for the audience where there are threats in people, institutions, and policies. They tend to do so through hyperbole, through overstatement, through slippery slope language saying, if this happens, then this awful thing will happen. And they frame their content as morally serious. Whereas a comedian engages in political commentary and says, oh, but I'm just a comedian.
Right.
The outrage hosts
mean it.
That's right. You don't watch Sean Hannity and think he's just trying this on for size.
Well, let me play another clip. And this is it's an edited clip of conservative commentator Glenn Beck on liberal comedian and commentator Samantha Bee's TBS show Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. And this aired shortly after President Trump was elected president. I should just say, full disclosure here, my son is an editor on Samantha Bee's show. But let's listen to this clip and then we'll talk about it.
Why would you have me on if you don't want to mock? Why should you have me?
Because
on?
I think that our future is going to require a broad coalition of nonpartisan decency.
Agree. I'm not a pessimist. I'm a catastrophist. Have you watched me?
Yeah, I thought you might have changed that part.
No, that part remains right intact.
Okay.
I hate to break it to you.
Uh-huh.
See, I've been watching you.
Right.
You've adopted a lot of my catastrophe kind of traits.
I'm a catastrophist.
You are.
In the mode of Glenn Beck?
Let me ask you this.
Sam B's having a Christmas crisis.
Do you believe there's a chance we fall into a dictatorship under Donald Trump?
Oh, God.
Do you believe there's a chance we lose our freedom of speech and press under this president?
Glenn Beck is going to make me cry.
I'm sorry. Somebody has to say it.
Again, a clip from Sam B's show. I do think, though, listening to that, Dana, that was sort of like that Christmas truce during World War I.
Where
people came out of the trenches, they celebrated, I think.
To play ball
and be friends, and then they went back to fighting
again. Then they went back to it. I use this segment to open the book because, to me, it signifies something interesting about Samantha Bee's own awareness of what her show is doing. The fact that she invited Glenn Beck on and aired this after it was recorded, and he said all these things, and aired it in the spirit, I think, of humility, perhaps even acknowledging maybe there's a little bit of what he's saying that's true,
right?
That maybe I am similar to what he did when he was on Fox News.
You think she's right?
She's right or he's right? That she's a catastrophist?
Well, do you think that there is something of these sort of two different camps that they do share?
Yes. So, and people on both sides get mad when I say that. So I'll just explain. We'll get mad. So there are certain traits that are shared, political characteristics. People who consume outrage on the right and who consume satire on the left are, as you said in your introduction, more politically knowledgeable, more politically interested, more likely to talk politics, more likely to be participatory, more likely to be confident in their own ability to navigate the political world, all things that we consider positive for democratic health, right? In general, we think these are good things. The difference is in, of course, the valence and the partisan nature of that information. I'm careful not to say that they're not the same. And in fact, the frame surrounding outrage and the psychology of conservatism, I believe, renders outrage a dangerous proposition for democratic health. And we can get into that.
I'm holding my book up, which means we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Our guest is Dana Goldthwait-Young. She's got a new book. It's called Irony and Outrage. It's subtitled The Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter in the United States. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I can see some emails already. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dana Goldthwait-Young. She's an associate professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware, also at the University Center for Political Communication. She's also an improv comedian and has performed with Comedy Sports Philadelphia for just about 20 years. I do want to read some emails here, but let's talk a little bit about this kind of psychology, such as it is, the psychological mindset of a conservative and a liberal. How do you see that?
So when I was trying to figure out the answer to this question of why it is that there is so few examples of successful satire on the right, and why it is that both sort of financially and sort of in spirit, the outrage genre has been more successful for conservatives than liberals. I didn't have a really good answer for that for a long time until I started looking at the literature on political psychology. And so for a couple decades now, we've had political psychologists looking at the underlying psychological traits that are distinct between liberals and conservatives. So we think of ourselves as different on perhaps on issues. Right. But in fact, liberals and conservatives differ in their fundamental motivations that shape how they engage with and process the world around them. And to make it simple, I'll just say conservatives tend to be more oriented towards threats in their environment for biological and physiological reasons. So they're
Fight, flight?
Yes. Thing? So they're sort of, I think about it in terms of being hardwired. That's not to say it's determined completely and that people can't change, but just that there are predispositions that render certain people more likely to be orienting towards threats in their environment. And as such, they're more likely to come to decisive conclusions very quickly, often based on gut reactions and emotional responses. And that makes them really efficient judgment makers, right? Now, those are conservatives. Liberals, on the other hand, tend to be more likely to take more time and process information coming in and put it against the information they have and say, does this information make sense? Does it not? So liberals also are less likely to be monitoring for threat. All of that being said, that means that liberals show a higher tolerance for ambiguity and uncertainty in their worlds.
And that's why, broadly speaking, they can resonate with something like satire.
And this is the case I make in the book, and I have to unpack what satire is and how it works. It is more cognitively complex. It is layered. It is ambiguous. The meaning of satire is not in the text. It comes from the audience. All of that means that the people who are most likely to create it and to be drawn to it and enjoy it are people who have a psychology that is more common among liberals than conservatives.
How then does comedy figure into this? Because mm-hmm. while there might not be late night comedians that skew conservative, there are conservative comedians. They just may not be up on the late night.
Sure. And there are a lot of really funny moments that you will get from hosts like Rush Limbaugh. You know, I know you had Brian Rosenwald on your show talking about Rush Limbaugh's success. And his book is wonderful. And he really does a good job articulating how Rush Limbaugh is an entertainer and people find him hilarious. What's important is that his construction of humor is not ironic. What he does is he engages in hyperbole and exaggeration, which, if you want to be boring, the academics call scalar humor.
So, I saw that.
Right. But, so he doesn't okay. He never inverts his meaning. He never says the opposite of what he means. What he does is he heightens the existing reality in a way that is preposterous and perhaps for some hilarious.
Well, let's play a clip. And again, this is from Rush Limbaugh's radio show. This is back in 1991 when David Dinkins was the mayor of New York City. Let's give it a listen.
If you listen to this show every day, you never need to read another newspaper again, never read another magazine. I do it for you, and you get a bonus. I tell you what to think about these incredibly complicated and controversial issues. So here is our General Dinkins update theme.
There's a holdup in the Bronx. Brooklyn's broken out in fights. There's a traffic jam in Harlem that's backed up to Jackson Heights. There's a scout troop short a child. Khrushchev's still wet eyed a wild.
General David Dinkins, where are you?
Now, Dana, when he says, I tell you what to think, is he being ironic there?
No. Absolutely not. So this is what kills me about some of this, is that I think that you'll hear and read conservatives saying, I was just joking, right? So you'll see conservative memes that are explicitly sexist or racist online. When I say conservative, I mean like far right memes. And they'll say it's a joke. It's a joke in the sense that it's meant to make you laugh, but it's not a joke in the sense that they don't mean what they're saying. They mean exactly what they're saying. They've heightened it in a way to be preposterous, but they mean what they're saying.
Well, then let me ask you about the president. When you see President Trump at his rallies, I mean, clearly these are his ardent supporters. They find him hilarious.
True.
I mean, you
True.
Can just watch, and they're not just hanging on every word, right. But they're laughing their heads off.
Yeah. Now, he is really a masterful. He uses hyperbole and exaggeration masterfully. Now, he confuses liberal journalists and audiences by saying, "I was just a joke," and I think for liberals, they're like, "Well, a joke would mean that you meant the opposite," and he doesn't mean the opposite. So. The example that I unpack is really delicious, and it comes from back before he was president when he was on Comedy Central's Friars Club roast. And the comics on that show actually wrote a retort for him to be able to then roast the roasters afterwards. Right. And so they wrote all these jokes that Trump could deliver at their expense, and they let him look at it. And what's so wild, when you look at this, the sheet of paper, he has Sharpied out all of the punchlines, Marty, and he's replaced the punchlines with just insults. So now, are those funny? Yes. Do they fit the logic of what we call incongruity in humor? Absolutely not. And incongruity is something that requires – it's like riddle solving. That's what it is. And it is cognitively complex.
A quick question here, because we got a lot of people that want to weigh in. Do you have to be funny, though, to deliver a good joke? And I'm thinking – and this is not a partisan thing, but I think President Obama was very good at delivering a joke. And I do think that humor has an edge to it. I mean, I always feel like the underside of humor is – if not, it's not angry, but there's a kind of unsettled edginess to it.
That's interesting. You know, there are scholars who have looked at both what are the psychological predictors of people becoming professional comedians and what are the psychological predictors of someone being just considered a funny person.
Right.
And they're not the same, Marty. This, to me, is interesting. The people who are considered funny by friends, they tend to have higher tolerance for ambiguity, right, or this sort of openness trait, but they also tend to be extroverts. Do you know that comedians actually tend to be introverted? So professional comics tend to be introverted. Now, they also score super high on tolerance for ambiguity, especially comedy writers, the people who are creating those juxtapositions. I think cognitively their brains work in a way that's always coming up with riddles to be solved.
Let me read a couple of comments. Actually, a question from Mike, who says, is your guest familiar with the Yale study done in 2017 that turned liberal voters conservative by making them feel afraid? This picks up on what you said earlier.
Great question. So what I like about this study and similar studies is that it shows that these traits, while there are propensities that are within us, that they are malleable. And so there are multiple studies that look at if you create a feeling of threat versus a feeling of invincibility, it does change actual political attitudes that people report having. There's similar work that's been done by my colleague Vin Arsenault, who's at Temple, right, looking at disgust sensitivity. So what this symbolizes to me is that there are these sort of innate propensities and there are these systems that can be tapped into and activated in ways that have profound political consequences. And I would argue that when you look at the content of outrage in particular, they are very aware of these innate sensitivities, particularly among our conservative friends who have a high sensitivity for disgust, who have a high likelihood of monitoring for threat. And when those are tapped into and activated, it does really lend itself to mobilization of those individuals.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Danigal Goldthwait-Young. She's got a new book. It's called Irony and Outraged, and it's subtitled The Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter in the United States. And she teaches at the University of Delaware. She's also an improv comedian. Let me read a couple of comments here. Emily posted on Facebook, my worry is that after being rather soft on Democrats, liberal satire is going to fall flat once Trump is gone, which raises, I think, an interesting question. If we're talking about political satire or even comedy, how much does it depend who's in power?
Interesting. Yeah, that's a great point, Emily. I'll say my concern is actually the opposite. I feel like the liberal satirists who we have now, because put it this way, just because liberals have a lower orientation towards threat doesn't mean they have an infinite tolerance for ambiguity and an infinite capacity to withstand threat. My sense is the reason that we see late night hosts today seeming more explicitly angry, right? Samantha Bee calling Ivanka Trump a see you next Tuesday. I would argue that that is because even they now are in this state of threat, where their values are being challenged, and that does make it harder to enter the state of play. So I actually see that Trump is not good for liberal satire, because I think it becomes a lot harder for these hosts to stay in the state of play. Hmm. So, you know, Trevor Noah has this great quote where Jon Stewart told him, as he was leaving the show and Trevor Noah was taking over The Daily Show, Stewart said, "You're going to get to the point where you're going to be angry and that you won't be able to find funny in it." And I do think that anger and play are mutually exclusive categories. I think when you get angry enough, you cannot truly enter the state of play. And I think that we see that in some of our hosts right now.
That's very interesting. Here's an email from Cliff. Does your guest look at online alt-right things like meme culture? I feel like they have basically appropriated transgressive humor from the left, using nihilism, irony, and sarcasm to advance racist, sexist, and anti-liberal views. That's an interesting point.
Yes, Cliff, that's awesome. Let's do a research study together. So, yeah, a lot of folks will say, well, I don't think that you're right, that liberals are the ones who are more successful at satire, because look at the alt-right. Right, meme culture. If you unpack these memes, they are capitalizing on pre-existing biases and heuristics, usually sexist, anti-Semitic, racist stereotypes. They call themselves ironic. They are not. And I mean, depending upon how you define irony, my definition of irony that I use based on prior work is that the literal and intended meanings are at odds.
Right. Intention, really.
Exactly. It's about intention. So these memes, they heighten existing stereotypes. They might try to protect themselves by calling themselves ironic, but in fact, they're tapping into these harmful stereotypes.
What do you think about political correctness? And I was thinking about Bill Maher, who really has a campaign against what he calls political correctness. And there was a quote from him from a year or so ago where he says the far left political correctness is a cancer on progressivism. But he says, you know, I can't go to universities anymore because people are so offended by what he says. How do we factor that into our understanding of satire, irony, humor, comedy, all of that?
I am so glad that you asked this. This is probably the toughest nut to crack for me, because what we're finding right now is that on the very far left, there seems to be something akin to a low tolerance for ambiguity with regards to speech. So these concerns about what are called microaggressions, for example, like there are words you cannot say, there are things that we cannot say, there are speakers that cannot speak. Now, I do think that those allegations are overblown with regards to what's happening on college campuses. I think that there is a conservative machinery that's designed to highlight those instances and blow them up to be bigger than they are. However, there is something there. My caution, and I don't usually agree with Bill Maher, but on this point, I will say I would caution liberal activists that if you are getting to the point where you are policing speech and you're policing language, you are actually demonstrating a low tolerance for ambiguity that is tapping into a conservative framework, a conservative epistemology or way of knowing the world. And you know what? Folks, think of your long game. What's your long game?
Interesting. Let me play another clip. You quote Terry Gross's interview with Stephen Colbert in your book. And this is an edited clip of Stephen Colbert talking with Terry. This is back in 2016 about his decision to leave the Colbert Report.
I thought maybe I would make some big mistake with the character, because he says he would say terrible things. And I got away with some of the terrible things he would say or do because it was all filtered through his mask. But if I didn't maintain the mask, it would just be me being terrible. And he would say hateful things or hurtful things. And I thought, well, if I don't play this tightly, if I didn't maintain that discipline, that it, I would simply slide into being like the thing that I was mocking.
He was actually talking about the character that he played, the Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report.
Right.
It's brilliant, actually, in so many different ways.
Right. So the character that he played on the Colbert Report was an arrogant, underinformed, or completely uninformed conservative pundit, sort of in the spirit of Bill O'Reilly, who would, quote, feel the news at you. and he was driven by his gut and not by information. What I think is fascinating about this, and I was really glad when I heard the interview that Terry challenged him a bit and said, what do you mean terrible things? What do you mean? What are you saying? And so he clarified a bit.
Yeah.
My research looking sort of empirically at how people understand irony and the extent to which they do understand it in the spirit in which it's intended suggests that he was right to be concerned. Because, you know, we know from work dating back to the 1970s that ironic humor, like, for example, Archie Bunker, when consumed by people who hold the prejudices of the character, can be used to reinforce a belief system. And I think that there is a danger there.
Even though there's Meathead, I mean, this was his son-in-law,
correct,
that who he called Meathead,
correct,
there to sort of challenge him on all his extreme and, you know, extreme views.
Right. So that the study that came out in 1974 by Vidmar and Roe Keech looked at different samples and that varied in their level of sort of prejudice, racial prejudice. And for those people who had racial prejudice, they saw Archie as the hero of the show, and they saw Meathead as the sort of target of the jokes, which is fascinating, right? Because I don't think that's what Norman Lear
not
intended
at all
with that show.
Well, which we're almost up in a break here, but again, gets to this audience, right?
Correct. The audience matters. And so when you start thinking about the psychology of audiences and how different people will consume information and interpret it in different ways, that really speaks to why it is that these genres that I unpack are so fundamentally different.
That is Danigal Goldthwait-Young, and her book is called Irony and Outrage. And we are talking about both those phenomena, how that shows up on television, in political comedy, among conservatives, among liberals. You can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Dana Young about political satire and irony, punditry, partisanship. She teaches communication and political science at the University of Delaware. She's an improv comedian, and she's got a new book called Irony and Outrage. Let me play again an edited clip. This is with comedian Michelle Wolf, and she's roasting former White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. This was at the 2018 Correspondents' Dinner, and we'll talk about it after we give it a listen.
We are graced with Sarah's presence tonight. I have to say, I'm a little starstruck. I love you as Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. Mike Pence, if you haven't seen it, you would love it. I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
That's painful, I have to say. And it should also be said that that's the last time there was a comedian at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I wanted to play that clip because you talk about the role of the audience when it comes to things like humor and comedy, satire, irony. And here, I mean, it's a tough crowd, I would assume. You just rolled your eyes at me. I assume maybe the toughest crowd there is. Nonetheless, what do you make of all that?
So if you listen to interviews with folks who have done the White House Correspondents' Dinner, they all say it is the worst room to perform in. It is the worst. I think that part of that is because everyone in that room is jockeying for status, and they're all self-important, and they all are there to be seen and to so no one is in their sort of authentic self. And when people are trying to put on airs, they're not going to let their guard down enough to be playful and roll with the joke. So it's just, it's a terrible room. Yeah. It's an awful room.
And she's not the only comedian that struggled there.
Right. That is true. I think that in general, it is tough. Now, my favorite White House Correspondents' Dinner speech was by Stephen Colbert in, I believe it was 2006.
A while ago.
I think it was 2006. And what he did was he used irony to perform as in persona, as his Colbert persona, and completely roasted George W. Bush.
Was sitting right there.
Face. It was the most wild thing. And the press. He also basically about their lack of inquiry with regards to the weapons of mass destruction claim. That was just fascinating. But back to Michelle Wolf. I think what's going on here, first, the first part of this joke where she talks about Aunt Lydia and A Handmaid's Tale, what's fascinating to me about that is that she got a lot of blowback because the meaning of a joke resides in the audience and not in the joke, people can contribute whatever they want to make sense of that however they want. And a lot of folks thought that she was insulting Sarah Huckabee Sanders' weight and her body. Now, she then came back and said, I think it's interesting that that's how people read it, because that to me says that that is what they're thinking.
Right.
Fascinating. But what she was actually talking about was about reproductive rights and about the role of women in society as comes through in that show.
Plus the reference to Mike Pence there.
Correct. So then the second piece of this is where I think she lost the audience. And I think she lost the audience because the meaning of the joke is in the joke. The argument she's making is in the joke. Nothing is implicit. It's not found through incongruity. She literally says, she says that she's a liar. She burns facts and she uses it to make a perfect smoky eye. You know, maybe it's lies. It's lies. It's definitely lies. So that is the point of the joke. So my prior work indicates that part of what allows people to be disarmed by humor is that they're doing the work to get what it means and they come to the conclusion themselves. And as such, we're less able to think, wait, is that fair? Is that right? Right? But you don't have to do the work. She says it straight up right here.
I was recently at a venue where Gilbert Gottfried was performing.
Yeah.
He has nailed, at least from my perspective, the discomfort, taking you on this long journey and you're just so uncomfortable and then turning it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, turning it.
And
the
next
end.
Thing
yeah.
you know, you are laughing with this whole right. crowd of people. It was just sort of a crazy, extraordinary experience.
When you look at different comedic styles and the art form that is comedy, it is such a joy and it's so fascinating. You know, someone like John Mulaney, who has so many punchlines per minute, it's just, it's wild to watch. In the different styles and how they all are on a quest to just elicit laughter, and they do it in these unique ways.
Dan wonders, does your guest differentiate between leftist humor and liberal? Oh, leftist humor and liberal humor? I was going to say leftist humor and rightist humor or conservative humor.
Wait, so the question is there a distinction between leftist humor, and liberal?
Yeah, I actually misread that. But yes, leftist and liberal.
Leftist and liberal. Well, what's interesting is when I did a bunch of interviews with some of the forebearers of the genre we have now. And Alan Meyerson, who was from Second City, Chicago, and then went out to start the political improv group, The Committee, in the late 50s, early 60s in San Francisco. It's funny because he talks a lot about how a lot of their work was targeting so-called liberals, that they considered themselves radicals, that the liberals were not liberal enough, and that they considered themselves sort of radical progressives. And when you look at the work of Lenny Bruce, he too was taking aim at, you know, self-professed liberals, and the fact that they themselves illustrated and exemplified the racist or misogynistic behavior that they claim to be against. So I think that right now, in fact, the late night comics that we have, that we see on TV, I don't know that they're truly radical. I think that they're, I'm going to go out on a limb, I'm going to make people mad, but I'm going to say,
this will be the second time.
Say, okay, well, there's a lot of outrage here, Marty. A little irony, a lot of outrage.
Yeah, right.
Dave Chappelle in his latest special, Sticks and Stones, which angered a lot of people on the left. I think what he is doing is truly radical, because he's actually taking aim at liberal audiences who say, you can't say this and you can't say that. And guess what? That's what true satirists do. They are outside of all of the ideological boxes.
Let me read an email from Jack, and then we'll play another clip. Jack says, what does your guest think of many Saturday Night Live alums being conservatives? The show usually harshly skewers Republicans more than Democrats, yet Adam Sandler, Dennis Miller, David Spade, and others are all conservatives. A perfect segue into Dennis Miller, who was on Jimmy Kimmel last year talking about being a conservative. And this is an edited clip from that interview.
When I watch Trump, he doesn't rankle me like he rankles people on your side. There are days I think he's a buffoon. There are days I can't believe the stuff he says. But today, when I watch that thing, I kind of laugh. Right. I watch Pelosi, and she drives me batty.
Interesting.
And I know on your side, I think Pelosi's kind of accepted. But when she says stuff like that, that drives me more crazy. All I know is when I look at, like I said, socially liberal, and that's when I don't dig what the conservatives do. They always come off like the town elders from Footloose, and that's a drag to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I look at liberals sometimes, and I think liberalism's like a nude beach. It sounds good till you get there, and then there's, a lot of cankles and misspelled tattoos.
I want to mention your...
That's pretty funny.
It is pretty funny. You know, I've told a joke in the past that, you know, when people say, why is satire so liberal? And for a long time, I was like, oh, no, there's conservative satire. And I say, oh, there's Larry the Cable Guy. And I'm like, oh, well, no, he's not a satirist. He's just a comic. And I say, oh, well, there's Dennis Miller. But he's not funny. But he's funny. He can be very funny. I think a lot of times when he's making political points, he comes off as more strident and didactic. Not your guest. I'm your guest. Who's what do we call the person who wrote the email or the call?
Oh, our listener?
Our listener, Marty.
So yes, our listener.
Oh,
people
good, good.
Are listening to
oh,
us.
Good. Oh, it's not just us.
Not just
oh, good.
Us
okay. So your listener says, you know, what about these former SNL actors who are conservative? I still think that it tends to be more of a minority. I think the overwhelming majority of these professional comics are liberal. But then again, it is fascinating. And I think that for folks who are in the world of comedy, who are truly trying to push boundaries, when they come up against some of the quote-unquote rules of the far left, I think it pushes them more to the middle or the right. So when you have someone like Jerry Seinfeld or Chris Rock who say, I cannot perform on college campuses because the students tell me that what I say, I'm not allowed to say. That kind of frustration is going to result in a change in political viewpoint.
You know, a lot has been said, and you write a lot about Fox News Channel, Tucker Carlson, and a bunch of the hosts there, as you say, kind of the outrage machine. I'm just curious, how do you see MSNBC? Because many people say, oh, well, that's the liberal equivalent of Fox News. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I do not. And the reason why is because I think, first of all, when Fox News was created in 1996, it was created with the mission explicitly of being a response to what was perceived as dominant liberal mainstream media. So that is its reason for being. When MSNBC came on the scene, they actually began as a place that had all different viewpoints. So, you know, folks might not know that Ann Coulter was over there, and so was Tucker Carlson back in the day. So as MSNBC sort of floundered in figuring out how to position itself, it eventually became a response, sort of the liberal response, to Fox News. However, the reason that I say it's not the liberal Fox is because I think that misunderstands the psychology of liberalism. When Rachel Maddow does her show, she's not actually doing outrage in the same exact way that Sean Hannity is. Her show will take you on this sort of long, winding road. And she's often using irony. She's often saying things, and she has this incredulous sort of like college professor. Yeah, what is happening? Right? She doesn't come across as angry and saying, these are the enemies, everybody. Go get them. So it is fundamentally different. I think it's easy to say MSNBC is the Fox News of the left. I think it's easy. But I would challenge people to understand sort of a liberal psychology and see perhaps political satire is that thing.
Do you see then? I mean, in certain ways, these are camps. Mm-hmm. It feels very tribal, mm-hmm. you know, that you'd sort of connect with either people or ideas that just sort of make you feel like you belong. And it's interesting. I mean, I don't think there were the good old days when we all, you know, loved each other unquestionably. Certainly in the 1950s, you had a lot of the John Birch Society. You had a lot of really extreme groups that were mm-hmm. Working the airwaves. Do you see, though, a sort of living in these parallel universes as things become either more partisan or more political, or it feels like more is at stake?
I think, you know, I apologize for being a media determinist, but that's who I am. The economics of our media system are such that if you combine what drives the economics of American media, which is advertising, with the technological changes themselves, which have created tiny niche spots where we can find teeny tiny homogenous audiences, that machinery is going to drive people into these little enclaves where they will be with like-minded individuals and where media executives will create content that is customized towards that homogenous audience's psychological traits, their demographics, and the things that they like and dislike. And to the extent that this continues through social media algorithms, etc., the economics of media are driving us apart.
I wonder, though, and that's a lot about confirmation bias, where you seek out the things that tell you that you're right, but whether, you know, not to be too pie in the sky here, but whether there's something about humor that could actually bring us together.
Yeah, I think that that's possible. Folks ask me that a lot. I think it is possible, but just to pivot, I would say that even more than humor, I think that narrative storytelling, testimonials that elicit empathy, I think we know from some of the work from media psychology that that kind of content is actually really well suited towards bridging these divides, getting people to take other people's perspectives, to lose themselves in someone else's story that's unlike themselves, gets people to be a bit disarmed, but also to feel emotionally vulnerable on another person's behalf. I think that there's promise there.
Almost out of time. Should we all then be doing improv? Would that help us?
Great question, Marty. That's my second book. Yeah. That in order to increase our tolerance for ambiguity and to increase our... And the thing that tolerance for ambiguity does is it invites you to think, maybe I'm wrong. And I think we all need more of that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll just say, take this little step, but maybe I'm wrong. And that's okay.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And our guest has been Danegal Goldthwait-Young. And again, she's got a new book. It's called Irony and Outrage, the Polarized Landscape of Rage, Fear, and Laughter in the United States. She's an associate professor at the University of Delaware. She's an improv comedian, a regular performer with Comedy Sports Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. And oftentimes we do have a Facebook conversation that happens or continues after the show is over. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.